I think I'm going to vary this a wee bit. We're going to have a meditation, but I think it would be better done just prior to the presentation. So I'll introduce Joanne Green first, and then we'll have a meditation for a minute, and then invite Joanne to come forward and give the presentation. Joanne has been a Unitarian for almost 55 years. Joanne's parents had moved to Calgary in 1950, and the city was a very conservative town. Still is. Like many families, Joanne's parents belonged to the United Church. However, her mother reached a point where she just couldn't teach Sunday school at the United Church any longer. Fortunately, friends pointed them in a different direction, and her parents joined the Unitarian Church of Calgary when Joanne was 8 years old. Joanne says that one of the most important parts of Unitarian life as a teenager was liberal religious youth. The group was more than accepting of differences, they encouraged the teenagers to think for themselves. In the late 1960s, there were so many political changes to think about and act upon. It was a heady time for Unitarians. Anti-Vietnam War protests, invasions in Czechoslovakia, and pushing for women's rights provided the backdrop to life in the 1960s. Now I would like to read a statement by Thompson Highway, an Aboriginal musician and storyteller, and an eternal optimist. And then I invite us to pause for a minute to reflect on the statement, and then invite Joanne to come forward and give our presentation. Thompson Highway. Native theology works in a different way to Christian and other faiths. There is no heaven, there is no hell. There's just a circle, the circle of life and death that interconnect, and that when we pass away, we leave this planet. We don't go up or down. We stay in another part of the circle. As we enter the reverent space of silence for a minute, let us reflect on where we stand in the circle. Thank you, and I invite Joanne to come forward now and give us our presentation.
Well, thank you, and good morning. I'm pleased to be here today. I'll never do the same quality job as some of the folks that have been presenters most of their lives, but I'll try. We're trying new things, too, and so some of what I was going to say is in the order of service, so I'll try not to repeat myself here. I'm going to tell you about this year's service package and read from parts of it. The CUC, or Canadian Unitarian Council, every year puts together a package of information for congregations to use at a Sharing Our Faith service. So they'll put together a couple of sermons or talks, presentations, however we wish to describe them, and other information, readings and other background information to use for the service. This year, the two ministers, as mentioned in the order of service, are Reverend Meg Roberts, who is a consulting minister in Courtney, B.C., and Samaya Oakley, who's a minister in Nanaimo, and I think a couple of you at least have heard her speak. So, sharing our faith, as it says in the order of service, it's a program of the CUC which encourages greater associational awareness in our congregations, fostering relationships and a sense of community. We've received grants from the CUC this past year, and I imagine we will again this coming year, assuming that we carry forward the part of the program that involves paying somebody else. Saskatoon has also been a recipient, to my knowledge, and other folks as well. This year's package is focused on Canadian UUs and our part in the reconciliation between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Canadians. This is a follow-up to a plan that we endorsed last May at the annual conference in Ottawa to develop reflection guides which will facilitate reconciliation between Aboriginals and non-Aboriginals across the country. So how are we, as Unitarians, working toward a process for reconciliation? First, let's look back a couple of years. In early 2014, the CUC Board and the Unitarian Universalist Ministers of Canada, or UMOC, endorsed an expression of truth and reconciliation that was presented to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission at their last national event in Edmonton, Alberta. Gary Groot, then the CUC president, and Reverend Meg Roberts made this presentation on March 29, 2014. And many of us, including our congregation, read the statement at a Sunday service in recognition of the event. After that event, an action plan was proposed and approved at our national conference. The action plan was broken down into three parts: assemble and promote lifespan educational materials for our congregations regarding the history and impact of the Indian residential school system in consultation with Aboriginal individuals and groups. Materials will be provided for adults, youth, and upper and lower elementary students. And those of you on Facebook or email may have seen information about contributing to a... Group funding, but not group funding. Quick. Crowdfunding, yes. Thank you. Anyways, there's crowdfunding campaigns to raise money to fund this process of preparing the guides. And include in the materials ways that congregations and their members can learn more about Aboriginal spirituality and cultures and work hand in hand with Aboriginal peoples to advance the struggle towards justice and reconciliation. Take action as individual congregations in response to the three commitments in the statement given in 2014. I think that probably the Sunday Service Committee will continue the work that's already been begun about listening to Aboriginal stories and finding ways for us to be part of that reconciliation. So what is our shared history with Aboriginal Canadians and our present reality? And most of the next part is from the two sermons by Meg Roberts and Samaya Oakley. And I know that lots of us know some of these things already, but so there'll be a bit of repetition here, perhaps. Reverend Roberts asks the question, how do I engage in truth, healing, and reconciliation? In a sermon she gave on October 25th, 2015 to the South Fraser Unitarian Congregation. She grew up in Saskatoon in the 60s and 70s. Her experience was similar to mine growing up in Calgary in the 50s and 60s, so there hadn't been much change in 20 years. Reverend Roberts says, and I quote, "The first ideas I had about Aboriginal people came from the Hollywood stereotypes shown only in movies. Then, when I was a bit older, I saw some homeless people outside rundown hotels close to the city center. I may have seen some Aboriginal leaders on TV, but I don't really remember. I remember talking to my mom about when she grew up on a farm outside of Sunningdale, Saskatchewan. She remembers my grandpa having a good relationship with some of the Cree men in the area who would stop for a chat when they were riding by on their horses. Now, maybe some of you know where Sunningdale is. I'm afraid I do not. So back to Meg's sermon. In school, we learned a bit in social studies about the people who were on the land before the Europeans arrived. But then it was about the Europeans after that. The one significant piece of history we learned in grade 7 was about Louis Riel, the second rebellion in 1885 called the Northwest Rebellion at Batoche. And of course, back then it was the Northwest Territories. We made a special one-day field trip to Batoche. We heard about the two-month standoff between Riel and his Métis fighters and the Northwest Mounted Police. We saw the bullet holes in the church, and so on. It is a treasured part of the history of that area, and Riel is a hero for many. But my education did not include what happened after that. Hopefully today that's changed somewhat. If you're non-Aboriginal like me, what are some of your early memories of learning about Aboriginal people or meeting them? And this is still Meg talking here. If you are Aboriginal, what are your early memories about learning about non-Aboriginals or meeting them? So while I was at elementary and high school in Calgary, my experience was very similar to Reverend Roberts. I did know a family in our Unitarian Church in Calgary that was both Cree and settler. I don't really have any memories of knowing the family as anything other than Unitarian, though. They were there and part of our group. On the other hand, I can certainly remember men and women near my father's downtown Calgary office that were clearly showing the effects of colonial policies. But we didn't talk about it at home. I don't remember it ever being discussed. Or I just remember feeling sadness. So Reverend Samaya Oakley's experience was a little different. She wrote in a sermon given in October in Nanaimo, "I can remember the day clear as bell. It was one of those moments that leaves such an imprint that it always stays with you. I was never one of the popular kids. At 13 or 14, I had bookish eyeglasses. Seriously." Oh, and for those of you who don't know, Samaya is blonde and taller than me and skinnier than me, so you just have to imagine that she is standing here in my place. But we do share the same glasses. These were the days before plastic lenses, and my eyes are bad enough that I needed Coke bottle bottom glasses. Add to that stringy hair and one of the meanest cases of acne you've ever seen. We were standing out in the hallway waiting for something. For what, I don't know. I was standing a short distance away from the popular kids, and across the hallway were the Aboriginal students that had started to come to the school. I can remember making eye contact with one of the girls across the hallway, someone who was not part of the in crowd like me, just like me. We stood there looking at each other, and I wanted to reach out to make a connection with her. But suddenly, I was pushed by one of the cool kids on my side of the hallway saying something like, "Come along, we don't talk to them." I can still remember the way in which she said the word "them." And I'm just imagining, of course. At the age of 14, it felt like it was a hallway that separated us. And it's only now, with my adult eyes, that I recognize it was not a hallway that separated us, but an incredible vastness of culture, attitude, and respective identity that separated us. I had no way of knowing that this gulf that separated us had its origins in a series of papal bulls called the Doctrine of Discovery. And it all started with land. And now, back to my own voice. For anyone unfamiliar with the term, as I was until recently, the doctrine of discovery was a papal bull issued in the 15th century. In Reverend Samaya's sermon, she said, "The doctrine of discovery gave Christian explorers the right to claim lands they'd discovered. Any land that was not inhabited by Christians was available to be discovered, claimed, and exploited." Joseph Trouche, the first lieutenant governor of British Columbia, was one of many who insisted that Aboriginals had never owned land. And I think they were right in that respect, because the Aboriginals didn't talk about the idea of ownership. It was there to be looked after and taken care of, but they didn't own it. So back to Reverend Samaya. Unceded land is land where no treaty has been signed, and therefore permission is required from the First Nation government before activities such as fishing, farming, mining, or the building of pipelines are engaged in. This stems from the Royal Proclamation of 1763 that declared all unceded, unsold land would be reserved to them, meaning First Nations. British Columbia is unique in Canada in that most of the province, an area that's about 95% of the land base, or nearly 900,000 square kilometers, that land is unceded, non-surrendered First Nations territory. The Sachat people of Port Alberni on Vancouver Island are an example of how the loss of land or home affects a people. Over time, what was described as a poverty of spirit began to descend on the people. The symptoms included that they lived listlessly, their curiosity of mind was stunned, they distrusted themselves and their ways and became suspicious of others. They eventually disregarded their own routines and traditions, and a sickness came over the people. They basically stopped functioning as a culture. Families broke down. The people were so traumatized that it became difficult to say yes to life. The other part of the doctrine of discovery had to do with the people living on the land. If the pagan inhabitants could be converted to Christianity, they might be spared. We've read about things like this in books set in the 16th and 17th century in Quebec, where the Jesuits went out and tried to convert people. If people did not convert, they could be enslaved or killed. So fundamentally, it was a doctrine of domination, of Christian superiority or supremacy, and it declared that indigenous people didn't have souls, that they weren't full human beings, and therefore should be enslaved. Reverend Oakley continues by saying, "It's this kind of thinking that allowed the Indian residential schools to operate across Canada from the 1880s until the late 1990s. These government-sponsored religious schools were established for the purpose of assimilating Aboriginal elders." Sorry, I didn't read that right. "Assimilating Aboriginal children into the mainstream culture." The Nicholas Flood Davin publication titled Report on Industrial Schools for Indians and Half-Breeds from 1879 included the assumptions of the 1870s that Indian culture was a contradiction in terms. Indians were uncivilized, and the aim of education must be to destroy the Indian in the child. Separated from their families and prohibited from speaking their native languages and practicing their culture, the vast majority of over 150,000 children who attended these schools experienced neglect and suffering. The impacts of the sexual, mental, and physical abuse, shame, and deprivation endured at Indian residential schools continue to affect generations of survivors, their children, their families, and communities today. So, What can we do to further the process of reconciliation? And by we, I mean Unitarians. Today, anyway. Many of us have attended seminars on Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Jane Knox wrote in the February Chalice of her experience while she's attending a series at the University of Regina, which is part of Project of Heart. Last fall, I attended a panel discussion on the Truth and Reconciliation Calls to Action, which focused on recommendations for the churches that were parties to the settlement, the residential school settlement, that is. Through these actions and others, we are today learning about the devastating effects of past government policies, such as residential schools. The remainder of this presentation is in the words of Samaya Oakley. She writes, "As Unitarians, our principles call us to join hands across all lines of ethnicity, class, age, sexual orientation, geography, and other things that make us different from one another, so that every person is treated equally under the law. In order to do this work, we need to begin the process of reconciliation, of beginning to understand how the effects of what has been done has been harmful to peoples different than we. We personally didn't cause these atrocities, but we benefit from it. And it is part of the work of reconciliation to learn how we benefited and to challenge the assumptions we all carry within." I think that's one of the hardest parts. "Our principles call us to do the work of looking for what is implicit, what is not visible, knowing that over 90% of who a person is remains invisible. We need to be willing to examine how Aboriginal cultures and practices remain curiosities, how treaties and laws continue to be challenged or ignored, how lands that are sacred to Aboriginals are taken and sacrificed to this new religion that combines capitalism and consumerism. We join as one to pledge ourselves anew to a greater understanding of who we are and what it is, what in us is true. As Unitarians and Universalists in Canada, we need to be willing to engage in a process of reconciliation, and the need for reconciliation cannot be made clearer. We need to be willing to work towards an end to the abuses and offenses that exist in our governmental systems and in our own thinking." And this is in quotes. "Reconciliation cannot simply become synonymous with interpreting Indigenous voices and visions in ways that are compatible with what we think we already know. Any real learning and change has to be a bit discomforting, painful even. And so, for us, an initial step in reconciliation is the recognition of a need to listen to Indigenous voices and visions, to those who have been wronged, and to try and address and redress those injustices. We do this as a people listening, knowing that as we listen, We do this as a people listening, knowing that as we listen, the interconnected web of existence begins a process of healing. We do this in order to build for tomorrow a nobler world than we have known. As we do so, that vast gulf that separated me and that young girl I made eye contact with as a teenager becomes just a little bit smaller. May it be so. Thank you." I'm not really sure. I think there can be commentary, but I don't feel qualified to answer questions.
Anybody have any comments they'd like to offer?
The comment that I have, or actually I just wanted to ask if you can read that quote by Davin again, because I think Dr. Mark Spooner was talking about possibly pushing for a renaming of Davin School even, and so I don't know if this is the actual Davin that is named for the school.
I believe so, yes, because he's referring to the industrial school, which was here, so yeah, it said... okay, the Nicholas Flood Davin report included the assumptions that Indian culture was a contradiction in terms. Indians were uncivilized, and the aim of education must be to destroy the Indian in the child.
Joanne, I wanted to say thank you for finding that information and, pardon? Helen? Okay, Helen. This group, of course, we've been looking into to issues around and gaining knowledge about First Nations and Indigenous peoples' treatment by the Canadian government over the years. And so all of us know quite a bit about it, and quite a few of us actually have participated in various actions at various times alliance with First Nations people. But I think that for me, I really want to move forward in that, in action. And one of the things that I've been doing is just, it's educational, but listening to Unreserved on the radio on Saturdays at 5, between 5 and 6. And last night on the program, various people who want to ally with First Nations and help move the cause ahead. One of them, John Ralston Stahl, has written a book that is only 90 pages, apparently, but includes a lot of information and also ideas for moving forward. And I'm going to look into that book and read it, but I thought maybe some of us might like to get together to sort of study bits of it and then try and choose ways of being supportive that count, finding out where to write the letters or who to contact and how to ask questions of people running for office, that sort of thing. So I'm just going to get that book. And if anyone else is interested, and I'm interested, Jane, in what you're taking part in the Chalice, you know, the piece that you wrote. I'm interested in kind of connecting with you about that and then seeing if there are other ways we can move forward and make a difference.
Did you, Jane, want to mention what that lecture series is about?
No, it's in the Chalice.
It's in the Chalice, okay.
Yeah, another idea, too, is to bring in more First Nations speakers. There's a storyteller, Joe, and I can't remember how to pronounce his last name, and he's fantastic. I saw him at, sorry? Yeah, Netahau. He was at the last Festival of Words in Moose Jaw, and he's just so down to earth, and his stories are very revealing. And I think so, it's kind of another way of bridging the cultures to know from a First Nations person who's telling the stories. And I loved that reading you did from Thompson Highway.
I guess this is kind of a challenge to Unitarians in the sense that we need to be more understanding or accepting. I know when I'm at a gathering and the elders are making a prayer at the beginning, and it sounds like so much hocus pocus to me, and I have to say, quit that, you know, try to understand what that means to them, and how do I bridge the gap?
Maybe it's a matter of time before we assimilate and become more knowledgeable. When I was a child, I quite glamorized the Indian way of life. We weren't near any Indian reservations. It wasn't until I came to the city that I realized that Indians were discriminated against. I had a good friend who was a Métis lady. Her father, she was Cree, Plains Cree. Her father was French. And she was a very good friend of mine. Her mother did not hide anything about being an Indian. She could do all the Indian beadwork, and she was a marvelous lady. When we went to school, we had debates on Louis Riel for and against. We didn't have one way of looking at it. I think it's a matter of time before we become more knowledgeable.
Any others? I think it would also be helpful looking back into time in understanding how the First Nations people lived on the land. None of us would be able to do that today. And they did have a very admirable culture, and we should be more aware of that. And we have destroyed it and left them with nothing.